I grew up in Northwest Washington and grew up in the little town of Linden, Washington. And if you can recognize this here, it's actually a windmill, and it's a Dutch windmill. And the town of Linden is known for its Dutchness, if there is such a thing, full of Hollanders. There's more than that, but that's predominantly what's there. And it has a bit of a quaint Dutch flavor and in its history, and it has tidy farms that are located throughout the Nooksack Valley. And they have a special event early in May. It's called Holland Days, I think it is. Holland Days. And they're wearing their traditional Dutch clothing. And it's also noted for its number of Christian Reformed churches being associated with the Dutch folk. I remember there was First Christian Reformed Church, and there was Second Christian Reformed Church, and there was Third Christian Reformed Church, and then they finally broke the mold, and it went to Bethel Christian Reformed Church. Now, I don't know how many there are today. That was 30-some years ago. I think my grandparents went to Third, and we went to Bethel. So that much I can remember from back there. Now, you may have seen in most towns there is a First Baptist Church, and you have to say it, Baptist. If you're from the South, it's Baptist, not Baptist, it's Baptist. Because I used to live in Tennessee, and I learned that's how you talk in Tennessee. And I have actually seen some Second Baptist churches. Not many, but there are some. You have to look a little harder. Because there aren't as many people who want to be second anything. So it's rare to have that designation. There is second fiddle, or violin, if you prefer, and many other positions. If you're part of an orchestra, you have these positions, and as you enhance your skills, you may work your way up to the first chair, and that's always the cool thing that you're aiming for. And how many teams are there out there, besides the Lobos, who would want to be in second place? Don't take that personally. But second place would be okay. I mean, if we could pull that off. But there aren't that many teams whose aspiration is, let's be second. It's just not usually the way things work, unless it's working your way up. And that's why the Lobos would be happy if they could get to second place. Because the last couple, 3 years hasn't been all that good. So it's not something that we generally have an aspiration toward. Or how many people are there who have the aspiration of being vice president? Unless you're working your way up, then vice president sounds great. Or maybe you have a particular skill in some companies where there are lots of different vice presidents. To have that position is perhaps better than being president. It's a matter of perspective in some ways. But somebody has to have those positions. Somebody has to be second. So the character, as we're doing a character study right now of some Old Testament characters and thinking about character in the process, the character we want to consider today has the distinction of being in second place, or being the second in command, sort of. And even then, it's not exactly that, but at some of the time, that seems to be the case. And so I wonder if there's something, if there's some lesson, if there's some principle, if some insight that we can gain from looking at someone who served in second place. What might we gain from that? Or what does it take to be number two in God's service? Or the equivalent. So, I want to think about the capability factor. Several different factors that are involved, different parts of this equation. There's the capability factor, and, well, we're kind of right in the middle of an election year, and, well, we're right near the end of it, we're hoping. We're hoping things will go the way that we particularly want it to go. And we have someone who is seeking the primary position, and we have somebody who's seeking the secondary position. And one of the things that we want to know is, are they capable? The capability factor. And so we will be giving that some consideration in the voting booth, but we're also going to be giving it some consideration as we're looking at Scripture, as we're looking at service for the Lord. Is there the capability that we need to serve in whatever position, whether it's first position or second or third or whatever on down the line? So we want to look at Exodus chapter 4, 10 through 12. Last time we had looked at Moses, we're going to pick up a kind of where we left off last time and build on that. It says in Exodus 4, 10 through 12, "Then Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So the Lord said to him, Who has made made man's mouth, or yours personally, or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say." So, the first thing that we want to think about is our excuses may not be without merit when it comes to our capability. Is there any truth to what Moses said when God said to him, "I want you to go to Pharaoh," and Moses said, "I don't speak so well. I'm not sure I'm the guy for the job." Moses may have indeed lacked a measure of eloquence. What we find is that God didn't refute it. God didn't say, "Oh, yes, you do. Oh, yes, you can speak." He just said, "Hey, who made your mouth? I said go do it, so go do it, regardless. So lay off the excuses. I made you the way I made you. Now go do what I've asked you to do." Sounds like something I tell my children. Just go do it. So God acknowledges that he makes people the way he does. And he promises to provide or to do what needs to be done. He says, "I will be with your mouth, so don't sweat it. It's okay." God had prepared the work for him to do, and he will work through him. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verses 8 through 9, Paul talks about the affliction that he had, that he wished to go away, and he had asked for it, and it didn't go away, and then he came to the realization that his strength is made perfect in weakness. That God excels in coming into places where we don't have what we think we ought to have, and then he accomplishes his will through us in spite of our limitations. We have limitations. We all have them. That's no excuse to not serve the Lord, is the idea. He expects us to serve in spite of, or even with, or through those limitations. Then we come to verses 14 and following. "So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, Is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well, and look, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do." So, it's almost an acknowledgement that Moses didn't have all of the eloquence that his brother did, and his brother was going to be able to be there, to be at his side, to be able to assist him through this. So God's provisions are not without sufficiency. In spite of our limitations, we can still accomplish what God calls us to do. Some have gifts in one area, some have them in others. And so Aaron is recognized as being capable of speaking for Moses. And God had made him that way, and he had made Moses that way. And so when it comes to the pile of excuses that we have, when God says, I want you to do this, is that going to be okay? Is God going to just take our excuses and say, oh, that's a pretty good excuse? Or is he going to say, hey, wait a minute, didn't I make you? Now we realize that we are in this fallen world and we have limitations. So God says, work with them, work through them. Who are we to argue and complain about our relative deficiencies? Those things that we can't change. But we are responsible for those things that we can change, and there are perhaps many things that fit in that designation. So we are to use our God-given talents for his purposes. Aaron had a capability of being able to speak, and Moses, for whatever reason, didn't to the same degree. God said, okay, work together. Get the job done. I will be with both of you. It can be accomplished. So he has a plan in mind. He had one for them. He has one for us. What does God expect me to do? What does God expect you to do? And what excuse have you given for not doing what he has asked you to do? I don't speak so good. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough brains. I'm too good looking. Some of us haven't resorted to that one, but then there's the chronology factor. This is an interesting one as well. Exodus 6, 28 to 30 says, it came to pass on the day that the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spoke to Moses saying, I am the Lord, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said before the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh heed me? He's coming up with another excuse. He'd already gone to Pharaoh once, and Pharaoh didn't exactly do what he was hoping, and so things weren't looking real good. The workload had increased, and so even though God may tell us that we have all that we need, and even though we may see and be reminded of that, we may still have feelings of inadequacy. We may still feel like, you know, I gave it a try, but I just don't know that I have it. You know, Lord, I think you made a mistake when you chose me. There's got to be somebody else. There's got to be another way. Because at times, life is full of intimidating things, intimidating people, intimidating projects, intimidating circumstances. And we may feel like yesterday was an okay day, but today I just don't see how I can do this. And what we need to remember is there are some things that are impossible for us to handle. Alone. Alone. God did say, I will be with you. And he did say, what about your brother Aaron? And God may be saying to you, what about somebody else who may be able to come alongside you? Or what about, did you remember that I am all that you need? because I made you. So Moses is reminded of Aaron's place at his side, which he needed to be reminded of from time to time. And he was told that Pharaoh would be uncooperative. He was told right off, you're going to speak to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's going to say, forget you, buddy. And so Moses is probably thinking, well, if that's the way it's going to be, then why are we going through all of this? Why don't we just forget about it? Because it takes time to unfold things. There is a process that may need to be worked through to get to the place where things ultimately come to realization. Are we prepared to go through the process, through the time and the challenges that are there? Now, anybody who's involved in schooling has a sense of what that's all about, because you are in the process of training for something and you are looking off in the distance and you see, I want to be there, but right now I'm here and right now I'm feeling like I'm not sure I can handle all of this. But God said, yes, you're going there, and right now it feels like you're way down, but I'm going to carry you through it. And there may be some help that you'll need along the way, but I'll be there. Do you trust him? Do you trust him? Exodus 7, 6. Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them to go to Pharaoh. So they did. And here is an insight, I think. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. Now let that sink in. How many birthdays have you had? And what is God asking you to do? And how tired do you feel today when you're thinking about, and Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83? We may feel that we are not the right age for the task. Now, I don't know if you can see these folks down here, but I love that picture. They look so happy. They're afraid that we're talking to them. It's like, you want me to do what? So here are Moses and Aaron, and they're well advanced in years. And who is the eldest of them? Aaron. And Moses is the younger. And Moses is the one that God called to be the ultimate leader. And Aaron is the one who's called alongside in this case. It almost seems that God doesn't care much about how old you are. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Who cares? While you're here, God has something for you to do. And when you check out and you're in glory, then you've graduated and you can move on to whatever he's got for you there. But in the meanwhile, we're here for a reason. It seems that God doesn't really have much in the way of age requirements for serving him. Samuel served God from his youth, remember, very young. Abraham was not exactly a spring chicken when God called him and had some expectations for him. Caleb was not a young guy. He was at least 80, if I remember correctly, when they had come into Israel, the promised land, and he said, give me this mountain, I'll take the mountain country, let's go. So there seems to be little evidence of retirement from God's service. Though there may be a change of ministry, there may be a change of vitality, because our physical bodies and even our minds do wear out to some degree. And so there does come a time when we have to modify what we can do, but there's not that sense of, once I hit a certain age, then I can say, all right, I'm done. I've done all I need to do for God, and now I can just coast into glory. I don't see evidence of that. So, then there's the assistance factor. Chapter 17, verses 8 through 10 says, and this isn't a huge one, it's just a little bit illustrative of a principle here. Verses 8 through 10. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. This illustrates the need to depend upon God. That's the first part of it. God may have a plan that doesn't exactly fit what we're thinking it should be. Because the plan was that Moses would go on the top of the hill and he would hold his hands up, and as long as his hands were up, then Israel would prevail. If his hands came down, then Amalek would prevail. Most of us would say, that's just silly. So sometimes God has a plan that may not be exactly what I think it ought to be. It may seem odd. It may seem backward. And yet, there's a reason for it. And the reason, I believe, in this case was to show that it wasn't just Joshua with the guys down below who are fighting. The battle was going on somewhere else, and it was illustrated by Moses depending and being obedient to God. And it's wanting us to see the connection between the two that we don't always see. Because we're too focused on, okay, Joshua, make sure you go and take care of that group over there and get somebody over there and then round them up over here. And we're thinking only about that. And God says, wait a minute. I am orchestrating things from up here. And we get all busy with our routine and we forget that, oh, God has a part in it. And I think that's where prayer comes in, depending on Him. It showed how man is to work in tandem with God. We're to do our part, and He has His part, and He wants us to work together. Verses 11 and 12. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, that Amalek prevailed, but Moses' hands became heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And so this rather graphic visual aid showed not only the need to depend on God and to work together with Him, but it also showed how somebody else came alongside him, Aaron and Hur, and held up his hands, lifted him up to be able to continue. I don't know how many of you have ever held your hand up for a really long time. It gets a little tedious after a while, and you just, oh, I want to put my hands down. I can just only imagine that even with your hands being held up, it wasn't the most pleasant thing. So there was a fair amount of sheer determination of dependence and obedience in that regard. It illustrates the need to provide assistance we may need assistance as well. And I love it when I can find actual footage of an event that took place. It's not always possible, but I just couldn't figure out which one was Aaron and which one was her, or him, if you will. Then there's the delegation factor. This one is also an interesting one to give consideration to. Exodus 18:13-14. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" Now, you're familiar with this passage. You understand probably what is going on here. Then continuing, verse 17 and following, "So Moses' father-in-law said to him, 'The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. For this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God.'" So he's essentially telling him, you're trying to take on too much. People need to know when to share the load and how. Moses had the right idea of, I am the one who is to sort of be the mediator between God and these people, and I need to address their issues and help them work through these things so that we don't have chaos. And the scary thing is that maybe this is the beginning of where lawyers came from, but don't take that too far. When you think back through what's involved here, there is a need for proper objective analysis. That is, the people needed someone who could provide some objective analysis with their problems, but Moses needed to have some objective analysis of the situation so that he could realize that as much as he wanted to do all of this, he couldn't possibly handle it all. We need to exercise a measure of wisdom to realize that we may not be able to do it all. We may need to share the load with someone, and we may need to accept some assistance. And we need the proper means by which to handle that. And it's not always easy to do that. And then look, beginning at verse 20, "And you shall teach them the statutes," that is, select from among the people those who will be able to help with this, which he's going to get to here in a second. "You shall teach them the statutes and laws, and you shall and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness," so they can't be swayed, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all times." It's just a simple principle of get organized and put things in place so that you have people who are able to work with those at different levels, and then the big things you can handle after they've already handled it. And that's kind of how our judiciary system works as well. You have things on the local level, and if they can't handle it, then you go to the next level. If they can't handle it, you go to the next level. Ultimately, you go to the Supreme Court, and they throw it out. Again, just being facetious. Sometimes that happens. People need to know who to share it with and why. Who to share it with and why. And here, the question comes up, well, why didn't he select Aaron to handle this? He was his right-hand man. He was the guy who was there to be able to help with things. Why didn't he just delegate the whole thing to him? Because it may not have been his particular expertise, for one thing. I think we'll have a little glimpse of that in a little bit. And the other is that there was another task that God had in mind for him. So it wasn't for him to do. And not only that, the people that he selected to be over these different people would have been right down with the people, and they would have had more of a connection. They would, and the way that he had it worked up with the different levels, it was far more practical, and it was definitely the way to go. So there is a reason, there is a way. And the question always comes down to, am I doing my part? Am I helping where I can, where I should, where I could? Or am I asking for help where I should, when I should? Are we doing our part? Am I recognizing the time to assist, the time to ask for assistance? Those are important things to consider. Then the position factor. Looking at Exodus 28, 1 to 2. Now take Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister to me as priest. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. Here, we need to recognize God's timing of positions. God had something in mind for Aaron. Aaron was 83 years old before he got to the position that God ultimately was preparing him for. That may be of encouragement for you if you're still trying to figure out what on earth you're supposed to be doing with your life. It may take a while. Hopefully you'll eventually figure it out. There are some occasions where we need to just jump in and do it and not be waiting, but there are other times when it may take a while, and there may be various experiences that we have to go through in order to be prepared for what God has for us. So we need to recognize that God's timing of positions may not be exactly what I think it should be or what I want it to be. Sometimes his timing seems to me to be late, because it doesn't fit with what I was thinking it should be. But if I jumped into something too soon, I might not have had some of the experiences that I needed to go through before I got to that point. Do my personal aspirations coincide with God's aspirations for me? Then recognize God's phases of preparation. Again, you may need a variety of experiences that you have to go through in order to be prepared for what God is aiming for you to ultimately do. And we don't always know what all that involves. But we need to recognize that that may be a possibility. And we need to consider the spiritual preparation that may be needed. And in this case, it's interesting how much time is spent in the text on the preparation that is needed to consecrate, to set aside Aaron and his sons for the ministry responsibility that God has for them. It was a rather involved process, but it symbolized being set apart to God from sin. And perhaps sometimes we don't give enough attention to that consideration, that spiritual consecration to what God has for us. Now, obviously, we have the benefit of his provision of salvation through Christ, and we have his righteousness if we've put our faith and trust in him. But yet there is a mentality that also needs to come into play. And then we come to the final factor. And so we need to look at Exodus 29. I think this was actually relating to the previous, but let me just remind you. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. It basically is showing that they went through this process. It was rather involved, and 7 days you shall consecrate them. So it was a fairly big deal, just again to recognize that that is important. Then moving on to the next one, the substitute factor. Think in terms of substitute with the idea of when your teacher isn't able to be there, you have somebody who fills in for me, and it's the substitute in that sense. That's kind of the idea. But first, we need some critical background and context to try to get a handle on this particular one, because this is kind of an interesting passage. So in order to, when we come to Exodus 32, we need to have some things in the background of our thinking before we get there. And this text in Exodus 19:7-8 says, "So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken we will do.'" Now those words ought to kind of resonate in your thinking, like, I've heard those words before. And maybe they've spoken them a time or two. "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And maybe you said those words. "All that the Lord has spoken, I will do." And then there may come a day when you don't do all the words the Lord has spoken. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And I'm sure he said, "The people said that all that you said, they will do." And the Lord said, "Right," or something like that. So Moses went down from the mountain, this is Exodus 19:14, went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes, signifying their consecration, separating themselves from sin, so they are prepared to be in the presence of God, kind of is the idea. And then verse 23 says, "You shall not make anything to be with me. Gods of silver or gods of gold you shall not make for yourselves." Now this is Exodus 20:23. Just in case you're trying to remember some of the chronology here. 24:18. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. It's a helpful little insight for us to kind of have an idea of how long he was going to be there. Reminds me of when I lived in Washington State. I remember a time or two when it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. But that's why everything is so green, unlike the desert. So while Moses was up on the mountain getting the word of God, the people waited impatiently down below. Note the word is impatiently. A strange abandonment of responsibility and judgment. What on earth happened while Moses was up on the mountain? Aaron was left in charge while Moses was gone. It sounds like Joshua went partway with him because he's coming back with him. So Joshua wasn't there to keep Aaron in line, in case you're trying to figure that out. So the people came to Aaron and asked for replacement gods, if you will. Exodus 32:1. "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron," because he was the substitute teacher, "and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt," and we're not sure why in the world we followed him in the first place, is what they're wanting to say, "we do not know what has become of him." So they are ready to give up on Moses. Not the first time they're ready to give up on Moses. But they were accustomed to the golden images in Egypt. They had been there for over 400 years. They had plenty of time to become acclimated to that kind of thing. Now, we've been in our country for how long? And look how far we have degenerated over just, you know, a couple hundred years. So it's not surprising that they were as far down the hill as they were. And it seems that they wanted a God that they could see and something else. Exodus 20:18 to 20 says, "Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, 'You speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die.' And Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin.'" In other words, Moses is saying, don't worry, God is going to be okay? He's going to take care of things. But realize that God is watching to see how you are going to respond and desiring that you have a healthy fear, respect for him. And so what they are almost communicating is they want a God that they can see instead of like the God that makes them a little nervous. They want a God that they can kind of control. They want a God that is not as scary, not as difficult to get your arms around. And so they thought they would make a God in an image that was much more manageable. Now, does that sound familiar? I mean, don't we kind of do that in our own minds? We kind of try to portray God in our thinking in a way that God is going to do what I want him to do. And that's the handiest God to have, isn't it? That's not exactly what God has in mind, however. So, going back to Exodus 32, beginning at verse 2, Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters." Sounds like our age and world. "And bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings, and the breaking off part sounds a little scary. I'm not sure what exactly they were like, which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So those who were speaking for the rest of the folks said, okay, here's your God. Now you can visualize him, and he's a little more manageable, is kind of the idea. There's kind of an element of syncretism that's going on here. So when Aaron saw it, looking at verses 5 and 6 of Exodus 32, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." Then they rose early the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Or our word would be party. Or it was a worship service, sort of, in their minds. But what you see is they've taken some things from Egypt worship context and some things from the Lord, and they've put them together. Not that we would ever do that. But do you know how easy that is to do? We don't even realize when we have moved into that kind of thinking. Then there is a serious reprimand and consequence. Exodus 32, 7 and 8, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go, get down, And he wasn't saying, get down and boogie. He's saying, get down the mountain. For your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So the Lord, obviously, knows what's going on. He lets Moses know. And then the Lord says what he would like to do. I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. Not the first time the Lord has said something to that effect. The children of Israel were an unruly bunch. The scary thing is, when you look at it, it sometimes sounds like us. We can be a little bit of an unruly bunch at times, or maybe just in our own hearts. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? He's kind of saying, you know, everybody's going to see what you're doing, and you brought them out here, and then you destroy them, and they're going to say, what kind of God is that? So Moses is trying to intercede for them, and verses 14 and 15, we read that the Lord relented from the harm that he said he would do to his people, and Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and he had the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. So then Moses comes down. So it was as soon as he came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing. So Moses' anger became hot. And Moses sort of carried the anger that the Lord had. And now it's like, ah, they really are doing it. They're really going again. I mean, it's worse than he thought. He even pictured in his mind and cast the tablets out of his hand and broke them. And it's interesting, he broke the commandments in a visible, physical, tangible way while the people were breaking them in a moral sense. And that, I think, is significant. So then he took the calf and burned it in fire and ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, made the people drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin on them? It's as if he was saying, did they hold you at gunpoint? Did they gang up on you and said, we are going to kill you if you don't make for us an idol? What on earth were you thinking, Aaron? I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking that he would be thinking, that you have brought so great a sin on them. So Aaron obviously is going to say, I'm sorry, it's all my fault, I shouldn't have done it. But he says, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. In other words, don't get so worked up. We would say, chill. Perhaps you know the people, that they are set on evil. And certainly Moses did know the people, and he did know that they were a rough bunch. For they said to me, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And so he pointed out that they were essentially giving up on Moses. They didn't know what had happened to him. And then there's this statement in chapter 32, verse 24. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. I love that. I couldn't have come up with a better explanation. I mean, if I mean, it just cracks me up. He was disassociating himself from what had happened. He was saying, you know, it was almost supernatural. It just sort of happened. So don't blame me. I was just sort of stuck in the middle. Now, when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron did not restrain them to their shame among their enemies, that is a significant statement. The people were unrestrained. The word that's used there means to let go or to loose or to make unruly. Aaron didn't do what he should have done as the second person in command at the time. He let them go the way that they were inclined to go. And then, of course, there was the consequence that came along of the judgment, and I'm not going to go into that just now. But that also was significant. But here's a question. Are we providing the support the church needs to restrain the people of our culture? Are we in the church sufficiently restrained ourselves? Are we the restraining force that we were meant to be? Because the Holy Spirit is referred to as the one who restrains. He is indwelling us. We ought to be part of that restraining force. The church has traditionally been that. But are we still restraining evil, or are we getting sucked into it ourselves? And then are we meaningfully, or are you meaningfully and faithfully serving in a number two role? That is, wherever we are, whatever supporting position, but actually the number two position is the place to be since God is number one. So maybe the number two position is where we ought to be. Anyway, and we should never think of ourselves in the number one position. I'm the top dog. Everybody look out. I am serving under God. He is number one. Am I serving in a supportive role as God intends me to do?